confirmation, sir. He couldn't see any lights pick him up on radar either, is that correct?
I don't know. I thought we were picking him up on radar when I came up here to Wheelock and talked to the mate. The sea return is real bad, but we thought we had the target. But I don't know. Now I wonder. Crystal, here's the mate. He was up here with all the whole thing was going on. Maybe you could get some better information from him. I might have been wrong on some of what I was giving you. What time was the last time that you had any cars or that you had a fit gentleman funny over?
1900, he was approximately 15 miles from the high hump at Crisp Point. That's when I was talking to him. He was 15 miles from the land.
You had him visually and on the radar, and you lost him in both respects.
No, I couldn't have him visually. I had him on the radar. He was exactly 10 miles ahead of us. I asked him how he was making out with his problem. He said he lost those vents and he had a lift, and he said he was holding his own. The last time I talked with him, he said he was holding his own, and that's the last time I lost contact after that.
That was approximately 1900, correct?
All right. We held him on radar up to between 8 and 9 miles, and when he got in the sea return, we turned the other radar on, and we really wasn't sure of any definite target after that.
The recording you just heard was between the United States Coast Guard Station at Sault Ste. Marie and Captain Bernie Cooper and First Mate Morgan Clark of the SS Arthur M. Anderson. The captain and first mate were providing key details of when they lost contact with the SS Edmund Fitzgerald on November 10, 1975, when the ship disappeared in a violent storm on Lake Superior with all 29 crew. The wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, today, on Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs. Hello and welcome to Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs, Tales of Mishaps, Misfortune, and Misadventure. I'm your host, Rich Napolitano. Today, I am bringing you the episode that has been requested far more often than any other, including the Titanic. That is the SS Edmund Fitzgerald. There is something about this ship that tugs on our emotions and clutches at our hearts. There are larger ships that have gone down, and some with hundreds or even thousands of lives lost compared to the 29 on board the Edmund Fitzgerald. Perhaps it is the working-class nature of the men on the ship, their grit, their determination. Perhaps it is the nature of the Great Lakes, beautiful and awe-inspiring, but also powerful and intimidating. Lake Superior itself holds 10% of all the fresh water on Earth, and it could fit the water of all the other Great Lakes, plus three extra Lake Eries inside of it. It's estimated that there are 550 shipwrecks on the bottom of Lake Superior, mostly undiscovered. And of course, there is the song which memorialized the Edmund Fitzgerald, written and recorded by Gordon Lightfoot in 1976, entitled The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. I can't play you the song due to copyright restrictions, but it tells of the struggles of the ship as it fought through a strong November gale on Lake Superior. I can only hope that with this episode, I can do justice to the loss of the ship and its crew. The keel of the SS Edmund Fitzgerald was laid down on August 7, 1957, at Great Lakes Engineering Works of Ecorse, Michigan. Hull number 301 would be built as a bulk freighter to operate on the Great Lakes, or, as they say in the Great Lakes area, she was a Laker. She was 729 feet in length, 75 feet wide, 13,632 gross tons, and had a listed carrying capacity of 26,000 tons. She was a massive ship for her time, ordered to be built, quote, within a foot of the maximum length allowed for passage through the soon-to-be-completed St. Lawrence Seaway. The seaway included the Sioux Locks that separate Lake Superior from the Lower Lakes. She was the largest and longest ship on the Great Lakes until 1971. The Big Fitz, as she was called, was not exactly a beautiful ship, but designed to suit her function. With a prominent pilot house at the front, she had a long, flat cargo area for her three holds, which were accessed through 21 watertight hatches. Powered by a 7,500-horsepower steam turbine engine, she could reach speeds up to 17 knots. Her hull was painted a brick, red, rusty color to match her rugged purpose. What she lacked in beauty, she made up for in speed and power. The ship was owned by the Northwestern Mutual Life Insurance Company and officially registered out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. She was named for the company's new president and chairman of the board, Edward B. Fitzgerald, who would later become a co-founder of the Milwaukee Brewers Major League Baseball Club, and his father was the owner of Milwaukee Dry Dock Company. Mr. Edmund Fitzgerald himself did not wish for the vessel to be named after him, suggesting instead names of Centennial, Seaway, Milwaukee, and Northwestern. However, the company's board of directors insisted, voting unanimously, to name the ship after their chairman. For the record, Mr. Fitzgerald abstained from the voting. Mariners tend to be superstitious people, and naming a ship after a living person is considered to be bad luck. Nevertheless, the new ship was christened on June 7, 1958, in River Rouge, Michigan, with over 10,000 excited spectators lining the shores of the Detroit River. Edmund Fitzgerald was in attendance, and his wife, Elizabeth, was to perform the christening. Mrs. Fitzgerald proudly announced, "I christen you the Edmund Fitzgerald. God bless you," and then swung the bottle of champagne. But the bottle did not break. She smashed the bottle on the ship a second time, to no avail. On her third attempt, with much effort, she managed to break the bottle to complete the ritual. A failed christening is yet another maritime superstition, and seen as a bad omen. But the bad luck didn't end with the christening. The Fitzgerald proudly slid down into the water amid cheers and applause, and then exploded into the water. The hulking freighter caused such a massive surge of water that it swamped a grandstand of spectators. Jennings Frazier of Toledo, Ohio, suffered a heart attack from the commotion, and he sadly died moments later. Another spectator said of the incident, the ship was, quote, trying to climb right out of the water. The celebration of the ship's launch quickly turned into a somber affair. Northwestern Mutual didn't operate the Edmund Fitzgerald directly, as was their custom. The ship was contracted under a long-term charter to the Ogilby Norton Ore Mining Company, based out of Cleveland, Ohio. The Big Fitz, as she was called, made her regular runs from Silver Bay, Minnesota, to Detroit and Toledo. The ship delivered taconite, a form of iron ore pellet, from mines near Duluth, Minnesota, to steel mills in the Lower Lakes area. Despite the bad omens, the Big Fitz proved her seaworthiness after 9 days of sea trials. On September 24, 1958, she took her maiden voyage under Captain Bert Lambert and passed through the Sioux Locks for the first time. On her return voyage, she set the record for the largest load carried through the locks. The Edmund Fitzgerald soon became the star of Great Lakes shipping, often surpassing her own records. In 1959, command of the Big Fitz was passed on to Captain Newman C. Larson, an experienced mariner who had been guiding ships on the Great Lakes for 20 years. Then in 1966, a very colorful character, Captain Peter Pulser, took over as skipper of the Edmund Fitzgerald. He became affectionately known as the DJ Captain. Captain Pulser consistently played music through the ship's loudspeakers, day and night, while traveling on the St. Clair and Detroit rivers, to the delight of onlookers. When the Fitzgerald passed through the Sioux Locks, Captain Pulser came out of the pilot house with a bullhorn to give curious spectators a detailed description and commentary about the ship. While her owners and operators appreciated the efficiency, power, and speed of the ship, the Edmund Fitzgerald quickly became quite popular with the public. In addition to Big Fitz, she earned the nicknames Pride of the American Side, Mighty Fitz, and the Toledo Express. For a cargo ship, the Mighty Fitz was also quite well appointed on the interior. It had a contemporary design by the J.L. Hudson Company featuring tiled bathrooms, a deep pile carpet, leather chairs, porthole drapes, air-conditioned quarters for the crew, two dining rooms, a fully stocked lounge, and a beautiful map room. The ship also featured two staterooms for guests who received the VIP treatment. Once every trip, the captain held a candlelight dinner featuring exquisite food served by mess-jacketed stewards and the Edmund Fitzgerald-famed special Clam Digger Punch. For her first 11 years, she served without incident, averaging 47 trips per season. In fact, she received a safety award for 8 years of operation without an injury resulting in missed time. But in September of 1969, she ran aground at Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, requiring repairs. In April of 1970, she collided with the SS Hochelaga, again sustaining damage. And in September of the same year, she collided with a wall at the Sioux Locks. Within 12 months, the Big Fitz sustained damage 3 times, causing downtime for repairs and a loss of revenue. None of these accidents resulted in major damage, and the ship remained solid and seaworthy. During the winter downtime of December 1971 and January of 1972, the Fitzgerald underwent a conversion from coal to oil in Duluth, Minnesota, and was fitted with automated boiler controls. In addition to receiving mechanical upgrades, the Fitz received a new skipper, Captain Ernest McSorley. McSorley was a well-respected, no-nonsense veteran captain of the Great Lakes. He had been captain of 9 ships prior to the Edmund Fitzgerald, with over 40 years of experience, working his way up from deckhand. Captain McSorley was considered a skillful navigator and a man of few words, and perhaps a bit stubborn at times. But he treated his crew with respect, and he was the consummate professional. Despite McSorley's guidance, the Fitz ran into a wall at the Sioux Locks in 1973 and again in 1974. She also lost her 12,000-pound starboard bow anchor as it was being raised at Belle Isle on the Detroit River in 1974. However, once again, these were minor incidents, and the ship continued hauling its cargo across the Great Lakes. Hey everyone, Rich here. As much as I love telling you about maritime history, I also listen to a lot of podcasts, and I want to tell you about one that I personally love, American Elections: Wicked Game. There have been some wild elections in American history that broke all the rules of civility. There have been elections decided behind closed doors, elections that resulted in murder. And when you learn all this, and that we endured vicious, vile political contests over and over, you might come away feeling a little better about what's to come in 2024. From the host of American History Tellers, American Elections Wicked Game explores the entire history of presidential elections, from the unanimous and inevitable election of George Washington in 1789 to Donald Trump's surprise electoral victory in 2016 and his contested defeat in 2020. Follow American Elections Wicked Game wherever you're listening now, or to get early ad-free access to the entire series, bingeable now, plus hundreds of other ad-free history podcast episodes, subscribe to Into History at intohistory.com. The morning of November 9th, 1975 was no different than any other for the crew of the Edmund Fitzgerald. At 8:30 a.m., loading began of 26,116 long tons of taconite pellets at Burlington Northern Railroad, Dock 1 in Superior, Wisconsin. Her scheduled route was to cross Lake Superior, pass through the Sioux Locks, then south through Lake Huron to Zug Island in Detroit, a trip normally taking 5 days. While the Fitz was being loaded with 50,000 gallons of fuel and over 26,000 tons of taconite pellets, First Mate Jack McCarthy monitored three signal lights. Red meant the ship was listing to port, green meant a list to starboard, and white meant the ship was properly balanced. When the ship was fully loaded, 7-ton sheets of steel were placed over the cargo holds. Each sheet required 68 clamps that needed to be tightened down manually by the crew in order to make the hatches watertight. During the 6 hours it took to load the Fitz, Captain McSorley learned of a growing low-pressure system approaching the Great Lakes from Kansas in the Great Plains. November storms on the Great Lakes are notorious for their vicious gales, caused by frigid low pressure from Canada mixing with warmer air being pulled up from the south and converging over the relatively warmer water of the Great Lakes. These storms are referred to as the November Witch, the gales of November, and white hurricanes. In 1913, the Witch struck all 5 of the Great Lakes, sinking 13 ships and killing more than 240 men. Winds were estimated at 90 miles per hour, with waves of more than 35 feet, accompanied by whiteout snow squalls. These are conditions the Fitzgerald would soon experience firsthand. Despite the reputation of the November Witch, McSorley was not concerned. The veteran captain had been through countless gales on the lakes and had seen it all and conquered all. He was confident the Fitz could handle whatever the lake could throw at her. It was late in the shipping season, and McSorley promised his wife this would be his last, and he was looking forward to returning home for good. The crew of the Fitzgerald was a mix of younger men, full of energy and seeking adventure, and veteran seamen, whose hands and backs showed their years of service. The ship was their home while on the lakes. They ate together, shared quarters, worked together, and laughed together. Each man relied on the next for his livelihood and his life. One of the crew was an unexpected last-minute addition. The ship's regular chief cook, Duane Shunick, was late disembarking from another ship. He was replaced by 62-year-old Robert Rafferty. Ironically, Shunick also narrowly missed being sent to Okinawa during World War II, when the war ended while he was en route. At 2:30 p.m., the Edmund Fitzgerald departed Superior, Wisconsin. About the same time, another cargo ship, the SS Arthur M. Anderson, departed Two Harbors, Minnesota, with Captain Bernie Cooper in command. They didn't know the storm to the south was rapidly intensifying. At 2:39 p.m., the National Weather Service issued a gale warning for Lake Superior. Captain Cooper on the Anderson immediately radioed a ship he saw some miles away. This was the Edmund Fitzgerald. Captain Cooper and Captain McSorley agreed to travel together and remain in radio contact with each other. They also agreed to continue on the customary Lake Carriers Association route across the middle of the lake. The Fitzgerald was the faster ship, with its top speed at 14 knots, or about 16 miles per hour, and it stayed roughly 15 miles ahead of the Anderson. Another cargo ship, the SS Wilfred Sykes, was loaded alongside the Edmund Fitzgerald and departed about 2 hours afterward. Its captain, Dudley J. Paquette, heard the radio conversations between McSorley and Cooper and their decision to remain on course. Captain Paquette, right from the start, chose a more northerly route, closer to the Canadian shore to avoid the oncoming storm. By 7 p.m., the situation had drastically changed. The National Weather Service updated its forecast and issued gale warnings for the entirety of Lake Superior. After a quick conversation, McSorley and Cooper decided to alter their course out of the traditional shipping lanes and veer to the north, hoping to be protected from the worst of the storm. This was out of ordinary for McSorley, who was known to stay on course at all costs. Clearly, he was convinced the impending storm posed a threat. As the Fitz and the Anderson veered north, the winds and waves continued to grow in their fury. At 1 o'clock a.m., now November 10th, the Fitzgerald was 20 miles south of Isle Royale, off the Canadian shores, and visibility was less than 2 miles in the driving rain. Her position was slightly west of the dead center of Lake Superior. McSorley again contacted the Arthur M. Anderson, reporting 60-mile-an-hour winds and waves up to 10 feet. The Fitzgerald was already taking a beating, with a long voyage still ahead of her. Captain Paquette on the Wilfred Sykes heard McSorley say he was reducing speed, and then say, "We're going to try for some lee from Isle Royale. You're walking away from us anyway. I can't stay with you." In other words, he was attempting to use the island as protection from the high winds. Despite his confidence in his powerful freighter, McSorley was seeking a safer route. By 2 o'clock a.m., the National Weather Service issued yet another update, a storm warning with winds up to 60 miles per hour and 15-foot waves. The Arthur M. Anderson stayed a bit to the south on a more direct route and did not veer as close to Isle Royale as the Edmund Fitzgerald. As a result, the Anderson was now in front of the Fitz, further to the east. But the Fitzgerald, the faster ship, got out ahead of the Anderson around 3 o'clock a.m. In those early morning hours, the center of the storm passed directly over the two ships, and wind speeds temporarily dropped. But the wind direction shifted, first northeast, then south, then northwest, causing swirling conditions and harsh currents. Throughout the morning and into the early afternoon, the two ships chugged and struggled through the vicious winds and waves, turning to the southeast toward Whitefish Bay at the entrance to the Sioux Locks. Captain Cooper made visual contact with the Fitzgerald and watched as she rounded Caribou Island, located in the eastern third of Lake Superior. He commented to his crew that the Fitzgerald was far too close to Six Fathom Shoal for his liking. This was a well-known, dangerous reef to the north of Caribou Island, and the Anderson stayed slightly more to the east than the Fitzgerald to avoid it. Sean Lee, a development officer at the Great Lakes Shipwreck Museum at Whitefish Point Light Station, writes of Captain Cooper. He and his officers watched the Fitzgerald pass right over the dangerous area of shallow water. By this time, snow and rising spray had obscured the Fitzgerald from sight, visible 17 miles ahead on radar. At 3:20 p.m., the Anderson contacted the Edmund Fitzgerald, reporting winds of 43 knots, or about 50 miles per hour. At 3:30 p.m., McSorley replied,
"Anderson, this is Fitzgerald. I've sustained some topside damage. I have a fence rail laid down, two vents lost or damaged, and a list. I'm checking down. Will you stay by me till I get to Whitefish?"
"Charlie on that, Fitzgerald. Do you have your pumps going?"
"Yes, both of them."
Shortly after this exchange, the United States Coast Guard issued a broadcast warning to all shipping that the Sioux Locks had been closed and all ships should seek safe anchorage. At 4:10 p.m., the Fitzgerald contacted the Anderson again, requesting radar assistance for the remainder of the voyage.
"Anderson, this is the Fitzgerald. I've lost both radars. Can you provide me with radar plots till we reach Whitefish Bay?"
"Charlie on that, Fitzgerald. We'll keep you advised of position."
The Edmund Fitzgerald was in a vicious gale, in a snowstorm with towering waves, and virtually zero visibility. It lost both its radar systems, sustained topside damage, and was taking on water. The ship was in serious trouble, but Captain McSorley never lost his cool. Captain Cooper could only see the Fitzgerald by radar due to the poor visibility. At 4:39 p.m., the Fitzgerald reported that it could not pick up the Whitefish Point radio beacon or the light. Captain Cooper was now recording 100-mile-per-hour wind gusts. Captain McSorley radioed the Coast Guard station at Grand Marais on Channel 16, the emergency channel. The Coast Guard informed him that both the beacon and the light were inactive. Desperate, the Fitzgerald sent a message for any vessels in the area asking for assistance locating the beacon and light at Whitefish Point. An answer was received from Captain Cedric Woodard of the saltwater vessel Avifors, and McSorley is told that neither the light or beacon were operating. Power lines had been blown down in the storm. With no radar, no shore lights, and no beacon, the Fitzgerald was literally blind and in danger of grounding. At 5 o'clock a.m., Captain McSorley asked the first mate on the Anderson, Morgan Clark, to check the Fitzgerald's position. Clark reported that the Fitzgerald was 3.5 miles from Whitefish Point, a safe distance. McSorley, realizing his ship was in trouble, slowed his speed to allow the Arthur M. Anderson to close the gap between them. Meanwhile, Captain Cooper was guiding the Fitz toward Whitefish Bay, as its radar was still functioning. Between 5:30 and 6 o'clock p.m., another communication was received from the Avifors.
Fitzgerald, this is the Avifors. I have the Whitefish light now, but still am receiving no beacon. Over.
Very glad to hear it.
The wind is really howling down here. What are the conditions where you are?
Shouting can then be heard from the Fitzgerald by the Avifors, and the words, "Don't let nobody on deck," can be made out.
What's that, Fitzgerald? Unclear. Over.
I have a bad list. Lost both radars. And I'm taking heavy seas over the deck. One of the worst seas I've ever been in.
If I'm correct, you have two radars.
They're both gone.
Around 6 o'clock p.m., the Arthur M. Anderson was experiencing winds of 70 to 75 knots, or about 81 to 86 miles per hour. Hurricane-strength winds. Captain Cooper later stated he was logging winds as high as 80 knots, or 92 miles per hour. At 7 o'clock p.m., the Anderson was slammed by two rogue waves as high as 35 feet, which crashed over her deck and destroying her starboard side lifeboat. First mate of the Anderson, Morgan Clark, diligently watched the radar, keeping an eye on the Fitzgerald to calculate its distance to other vessels and the shore in Whitefish Bay. But the surge of waves caused him to lose sight of the Fitzgerald on the radar from sea return, which means the seas were so high, the radar reflected back off the high waves rather than the Fitzgerald. Now positioned roughly 10 miles behind the Fitzgerald, the Anderson spotted an upward-bound oncoming vessel on the radar. This was the Nanfrey, a saltwater vessel, or a salty. With the Fitzgerald sailing blind, he knew he needed to inform the Fitzgerald of the approaching vessel. Clark spoke to the Fitzgerald one last time at about 7 to 7:10 p.m.
Fitzgerald, this is the Anderson. Have you checked down?
Yes, we have.
Fitzgerald, we are about 10 miles behind you and gaining about 1.5 miles per hour. Fitzgerald, there is a target 19 miles ahead of us, so the target would be 9 miles on ahead of you.
Well, am I going to clear?
Yes, he is going to pass to the west of you.
Well, fine.
By the way, Fitzgerald, how are you making out with your problem?
We're holding our own.
Okay, fine. I'll be talking to you later.
A few minutes later, the Fitzgerald sailed directly into a powerful squall, and the Arthur M. Anderson could not reach her on the radio or locate her on radar. No further communications were received from the Fitzgerald. Whatever happened to the Big Fitz, it happened suddenly and ended quickly. Captain Cooper called the United States Coast Guard and Sault Ste. Marie at 7:39 p.m. on Channel 16. But the Coast Guard instructed him to call back on Channel 12 in order to keep the emergency channel open. They were also experiencing problems with their communications due to damaged antennas caused by the storm. Cooper then was able to reach the Nanfrey, explaining that he had lost the Fitzgerald on his radar. But the Nanfrey couldn't locate the Fitzgerald on its radar either. Several more attempts to reach the Coast Guard were made, but Cooper was not able to reach anyone until 7:54 p.m. Captain Cooper explained he had lost contact with the Fitz and feared she might have gone down. The Coast Guard replied, instructing him to keep an eye out for a 16-foot boat that had gone missing in the area. Officer on duty, Petty Officer Philip Branch of the United States Coast Guard, later testified, "I considered it serious, but at the time, it was not urgent." Cooper called the Coast Guard again at 8:25 p.m., expressing his concern about the Fitzgerald and reported the Fitzgerald was off the radar. By 9:03 a.m., the Anderson had reached the relative safety of Whitefish Bay when the Coast Guard hailed her. Captain Cooper officially reported the Edmund Fitzgerald as missing, but with no ships available for rescue missions, the Coast Guard officer on duty asked Cooper to take the Anderson back out into the storm and search for the Fitzgerald. Cooper was reluctant, citing the harsh conditions and difficulty sailing against those currents. In a later interview, Cooper said he feared there would be two ships on the bottom if he went back out. But eventually he agreed, saying, "Well, I'll go back and take a look, but God, I'm afraid I'm going to take a hell of a beating out there. I'll turn around and give her a whirl, but God, I don't know. I'll give it a try, but that's all I can do." The Arthur M. Anderson began heading toward the last known location of the Fitz. although there wasn't anything they could do by that time. At 10:30 p.m., the Coast Guard issued a request for all available vessels in the area to assist in the search and rescue. At 10:53 p.m., an aircraft from Traverse City, Michigan arrived on the scene to assist. A Coast Guard helicopter joined the search around 1 a.m. on the 11th, and another freighter, the SS William Clay Ford, arrived at 2 a.m. A third freighter, the SS Hilda Marianne from Toronto, attempted to assist, but the weather prevented its voyage. The U.S. Coast Guard cutter Naugatuck arrived from Duluth, Minnesota the following day, and another cutter, the Woodrush, arrived on November 14th. The Woodrush was able to identify two large separate objects on the bottom of the lake using side-scan sonar, but they could not yet positively identify the objects as being of the Edmund Fitzgerald. Assistance was received from the Canadian Coast Guard, who provided aircraft reconnaissance, and the Ontario Provincial Police patrolled the eastern shore of Lake Superior. During the three-day search, two lifeboats from the Edmund Fitzgerald were found. Lifeboat number one was found 9 miles northeast, mangled and twisted, with its stern section missing and its bow pulled apart at the seam. Lifeboat number two was found 12 miles north of the wreck site at Mamance Point, Ontario. The boat was badly damaged, dented, and had a large hole toward the bow. Other miscellaneous items from the Fitzgerald were found, including a tattered inflatable life raft and 21 life jackets or portions of life jackets. But no survivors or bodies were found.
Just before Halloween in 1985, a pipe bomb exploded in an office building in downtown Salt Lake City, killing a man and leaving the entire city on edge. As the smoke cleared and investigators began the search for answers, it became terrifyingly clear that this was just the beginning. Suddenly, looking for the culprit became a race against time. Hi, I'm Jeremy Schwartz, host of the new true crime history podcast, American Criminal. We take you inside the minds of some of our most notorious felons and outlaws, exploring the dark side to the American dream. In our latest season, the desperate hunt for a killer leads the authorities through the complicated world of historic document collectors and eventually right to the door of the Mormon Church. Listen to American Criminal, The Salt Lake City Bombings, wherever you get your podcasts. Or to get early ad-free access to the entire season first, plus hundreds of other ad-free history podcast episodes, subscribe at intohistory.com.
A United States Navy aircraft detected magnetic indication of an underwater metal object. What was believed to be the wreck of the Fitzgerald was on the bottom of Lake Superior, about 15 miles west of Dead Man's Cove, Ontario, in Canadian waters, under 530 feet of water. A survey by the United States Coast Guard using side-scan sonar discovered the two large separate objects, and they determined it was, almost certainly, the Edmund Fitzgerald. It was not until May of 1976 when the United States Navy searched the area with an underwater submersible. They found and officially identified the Edmund Fitzgerald, broken in two parts. Its bow section was upright on the bottom of the lake. The stern section was 170 feet away, capsized in the mud. Debris of hatch covers and taconite pellets were scattered throughout the area in between the two sections. Several other explorations of the wreck have taken place throughout the years. In 1989, the Michigan Sea Grant Program funded a three-day dive survey to record 3D video for use in museum educational programs and documentaries. This project was carried out by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the National Geographic Society, the United States Army Corps of Engineers, the Great Lakes Shipwreck Historical Society, and the United States Fish and Wildlife Service. Their work resulted in various documentaries and educational programs. In 1994, the company DeepQuest Limited, led by diver Fred Shannon, privately funded a dive to the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald using its submersible named Delta. They conducted 7 dives, collecting more than 42 hours of video, and Fred Shannon himself set the record for the longest submersible dive to the Edmund Fitzgerald at 211 minutes. Shannon also studied navigational charts and discovered an error in the international boundary through Lake Superior, which separated the United States from Canada. Using GPS coordinates, Shannon determined that about one-third of the wreckage was actually in United States waters. This error was due to an incorrect position of the U.S.-Canada boundary line on official lake charts. Shannon concluded the Fitzgerald had suffered a massive and advancing structural failure at the water surface. During Fred Shannon's search, the shocking remains of a crew member partly dressed in coveralls were discovered. The crewman was wearing a life jacket, suggesting he was aware the ship was in danger of sinking. The body of the crewman was not identified or recovered, and no videos or photos were published out of respect for the family. The cold, anaerobic water at the bottom of Lake Superior preserves any bodies that make it down that far, slowing decomposition and preventing gases building up, which can cause them to float to the surface. Perhaps this is why bodies from the Edmund Fitzgerald remain in place where they went down. In 1995, Canadian explorer James B. McInnes led an expedition to salvage the ship's bell with the support of the Sioux Chippewa tribe. Canadian engineer Phil Knighton provided an innovative wetsuit called the Newt Suit in order to retrieve the bell, replace it with a replica, and place a can of beer in the pilot house to honor the lost crew. The ship's bell was recovered and currently resides at the Great Lakes Shipwreck Museum at Whitefish Point in Paradise, Michigan. Today, the Ontario Heritage Act requires a license for any exploration or salvage of the wreck. In July of 1977, the United States Coast Guard released its official marine casualty report. It states the exact cause of the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald cannot be determined. However, it does go on to state, "The probable cause of the sinking of the SS Edmund Fitzgerald was the loss of buoyancy and stability resulting from massive flooding of the cargo hold. The flooding of the cargo hold took place through ineffective hatch closures as boarding seas rolled along the spar deck." The report issued numerous recommendations, including the rescinding of the reduction of minimum freeboard and load line regulations. In other words, repealing recent regulations that allowed the ships to sit lower in the water. A number of other recommendations involved ongoing maintenance and repair to ensure the proper closure and sealing of the watertight hatches. But the Lake Carriers Association disagreed with the Coast Guard and refused to accept that the crew of the Fitzgerald were negligent in securing the hatch covers, or that the Fitzgerald was permitted to operate with damaged hatch covers. They strongly argued to the National Transportation Safety Board that the Fitzgerald suffered damage while passing over Six Fathoms Shoal, as Captain Cooper reported. In a later interview, Captain Cooper stated that he believed McSorley was aware that the ship was sinking as soon as he passed over the shoal. Others suggest the Fitzgerald was brought down by a trio of rogue waves called the Three Sisters, and they swamped the Fitzgerald in a cataclysmic collision. The Arthur M. Anderson was slammed by two such waves just minutes before the Fitzgerald disappeared. Another hypothesis blamed structural failure caused by the changing of the ship's winter load line, allowing for a larger load to be carried. Still another is that the Fitzgerald was struck by a floating object, perhaps part of the ship that broke free after being damaged. In July of 1992, the bow anchor of the Fitzgerald, which was lost in the Detroit River in 1974, was recovered. The anchor is currently on display at the Dawson Great Lakes Museum in Detroit, Michigan. The Edmund Fitzgerald remains the largest financial loss in Great Lakes history. Families of two of the crewmen filed lawsuits for $1.5 million against Northwestern Mutual and the Ogilby Norton Corporation who operated the Fitz, followed by an additional $2.1 million lawsuit filed later. Surviving families were paid compensation before the final findings of any fault or negligence and under the conditions of confidentiality. The native Ojibwe people in the area around Lake Superior call the lake Kichigami, roughly translating to Big Sea Water. This was later transformed into the name Gichigumi by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow in his poem Song of Hiawatha. The Ojibwe believe the lake never gives up her dead, and this is a common refrain still today for those around Lake Superior. Sadly for the men of the Edmund Fitzgerald, this still holds true. but we can honor them by never forgetting the fate of the Edmund Fitzgerald, or the 29 souls on board. Michael E. Armagost, third mate. Frederick J. Beecher, porter. Thomas D. Benson, oiler. Edward F. Binden, first assistant engineer. Thomas D. Borgeson, maintenance man. Oliver J. Champeau, third assistant engineer. Nolan S. Church, porter. Ransom E. Cundy, watchman. Thomas E. Edwards, second assistant engineer. Russell G. Haskell, second assistant engineer. George J. Hall, chief engineer. Bruce L. Hudson, deckhand. Alan J. Kalman, second cook. Gordon F. McClellan, wiper. Joseph W. Mazes, special maintenance man. John H. McCarthy, first mate. Ernest M. McSorley, captain. Eugene W. O'Brien, wheelsman. Carl A. Peckle, watchman. John J. Povajich, wheelsman. James A. Pratt, second mate. Robert C. Rafferty, steward. Paul M. Ripa, deckhand. John D. Simmons, wheelsman. William J. Spangler, watchman. Mark A. Thomas, deckhand. Ralph G. Walton, oiler. David E. Weiss, cadet. Blaine H. Wilhelm, oiler. That is going to do it for the Edmund Fitzgerald episode. Thank you so much for listening. I want to thank listener and friend of the show, Alan Nail, for providing voice acting for the dialogue included in this episode. Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs is written, edited, and produced by me, Rich Napolitano. Please subscribe to Into History for ad-free access to Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs and all the other great podcasts that are part of Into History. You'll be supporting this show and other independent podcasters so they can continue to bring you quality history content. You can follow Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs on social media at ShipwrecksPod. For photos and sources related to this episode, please go to shipwrecksandseadogs.com. Original theme music is by the talented wizard, Sean Siegfried. You can follow him on YouTube at Sean Secret or on the web at sean.siegfried.se. Thank you again for listening. I am truly grateful. Please join me again in 2 weeks for a new episode. Until next time, don't forget to wear your life jackets.